Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Will they, won't they, will they, won't they, will they join the dance? Biden says no. Netanyahu says yes. Who is going to prevail? How can Netanyahu not say yes? Because his cabinet have, by a majority, already decided that within 24 to 48 hours, what will effectively become World War III will begin. So hold your children close and listen carefully to tonight's show, the mother of all talk shows. Who knows? It might be the last time that we ever talk. It's going to be the mother of all talk shows. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
One is left almost speechless by the hypocrisy of those who rule us and those who scribble for those who rule us. Although sometimes I'm not sure who is scribbling for who. The mantra that Israel has a right to defend itself clearly does not apply to Iran. The mantra that there's a rules-based order, that there is a Vienna Convention protecting the inviolability of diplomatic premises of every country in every other country, is clearly bunkum. It doesn't apply to those that the Western Empire disapprove of. Otherwise, every single Western government would have condemned Israel's blatant, brazen, in the broad daylight destruction of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. They would have done, if it was anyone else, wouldn't they? They actually did, in the same week, do so when the mob in Ecuador sacked the embassy belonging to Mexico. They all condemned it. The rules-based order is one thing. The United Nations Security Council is quite another, because even the Security Council could not condemn this brazen act of piracy, which caused the deaths of at least 10 people in the Iranian embassy in Damascus. France, Britain, and the United States of America stopped the Security Council from condemning the Israeli bombardment of the Iranian embassy. If they had not done so, if they had condemned it, as they would have done for anyone else, as they certainly would have expected to have been done for themselves, then we might not be as we are this evening, on the brink of a conflagration from the Atlantic to the Gulf, and a conflagration that might very quickly escalate into a war between the superpowers, a war between the superpowers which would likely quickly escalate to a nuclear exchange, an exchange of nuclear weapons 1,000 times stronger each than the bomb detonated by Oppenheimer on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Irony dies all over again. The Israeli spokesman, I've just read it, said that Iran dropped 60 tons of weaponry over Israel last night. Most of it, they say, they destroyed before it had any chance to do any harm. But the spokesman tonight says these 60 tons of high explosives would have been very dangerous for the population down below. Could have caused, he said, enormous damage. He's the spokesperson for a government that has dropped 3 Hiroshimas on Gaza over the last 6.5 months, which did do a lot of damage, which destroyed almost 80% of all the buildings in the Gaza Strip, which displaced almost 80% of the 2.3 million population in Gaza, which murdered or maimed or otherwise left under the rubble almost 150,000 people, killed, wounded, unaccounted for, disappeared under the masonry, some of their skulls and bones now being used, yes, used by Joe Biden's government to construct a pier that nobody asked for in the port of Gaza. The double standards involved are simply staggering. The G7 has unanimously squeaked like the mouse it increasingly is that the attack on Israel last night by Iran represented a completely disproportionate, unacceptable escalation of force and risked peace in the entire region. That mouse, that rat, the G7, has not squeaked once about the mass murder taking place in the Gaza Strip. In fact, last night was the first night that there was no new dead Palestinian in Gaza of the entire 6.5 months. So at least Iran's attack had that benefit, that no Palestinian was bombed to death in an entirely disproportionate and 6.5 month long assault, which has become, according to the highest court in the world, a plausible case of genocide. So genocide is acceptable to our Western governments. It has to be, because we're still arming it, funding it, and diplomatically covering for it in international fora. So genocide is acceptable. But an act of exceptional theatricality last night, conducted by Iran, which didn't kill one person. Not a single person was killed. No synagogue was bombed. No hospital was bombed. No school was bombed. No house was bombed. The only thing that was actually bombed was the military airbase from which the F-35s that destroyed the Iranian embassy in Damascus took off, and well, that plane is now stored. And I'll come later to the ordnance used and its efficacy, evident from the post-mortem of the event. So killing nobody in a fireworks display represents a casus belli for World War III. but massacring tens, scores of thousands of people in Gaza with our money and our weapons. Well, that's all right, Jack. Well, you know, the tables have turned. Last night's event proved a number of things. First of all, it proved that, as George W. Bush might have put it, you've all been misunderestimating the Islamic Republic of Iran. You thought that its strategic patience was bluffing. You thought that it was all mouth and no trousers. Well, you're not laughing now, are you? Because what happened last night was that after a 2-week delay, Israel destroyed the embassy on the 1st of April, April Fool's Day. But who are the fools now, 2 weeks later? Iran waited for 2 whole weeks. It informed the United States and all of its neighbors 72 hours before the event that it was going to act. It had decided that it too had the right to defend itself, and that under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, it had the right of self-defense and was directly going to exercise it. 72 hours is a long time in warfare. It gave everybody the opportunity to move their assets around out of sight, and for Netanyahu to scurry like a rat into the basement of the private home of an American billionaire friend of his in Tel Aviv. He was all right, Jack, Netanyahu. Having given 72 hours notice, the Iranians then gave more notice. They put up into the air a squadron of drones that took 5 hours to arrive over Israel, which allowed the scrambling of dozens of Royal Air Force jets from the United Kingdom, American aircraft, and Israeli aircraft, and significantly Jordanian ordnance to bring down a substantial number of those drones before they reached the target. Who knew that the British could stop bombs? Who knew the UK and the US could have stopped the bombs that killed the children over Gaza? They could have shot them down out of the sky, we now know, at least according to the thundering tabloid newspapers in Britain. But the drones were a decoy. The drones were deliberately intended to draw the fire, exhaust the fire, burn the money of Israel and its friends. And my goodness, what money was burned. $1.1 billion was spent by the American taxpayer last night defending the rat Netanyahu in his bunker in an American billionaire's home. The ordnance used by Iran cost $68 million. $68 million spent by Iran, $1.1 billion spent by Israel and its allies, by which I mean the American taxpayer, because of course Israel ain't going to pay for any of that itself. Now, what happened after the drones? Well, the drones that didn't get shot down were then battered away, according to Israel, who knows, to the tune of 99%, meaning 1% of the drones and the small cruise missile ordnance got through. But there's only so much iron doming you can do. First of all, it's extremely expensive. Secondly, it's in rather short supply. Thirdly, what goes up must come down. And such damage as was done inside Israel in that phase of last night was done by the collapsing Iron Dome anti-missile ordnance. But what came next was the real enchilada. Iran, having softened up the defenses, having engaged the defensive systems of Israel and Jordan, then launched 8 ballistic missiles into a military target and destroyed it. The very military airbase that had been used in the original attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus, proving, one, Iran has real serious ballistic missile capability, and it only used 8 of them. It has 3,000 of them, and it has given thousands of them to its allies in the region. Isn't that funny? Iran has proxies. We have allies. Iran has allies that it has armed. And that's why missiles were flying from all parts of the Middle East last night. 8 ballistic missiles struck their target, were not intercepted, could not be intercepted, because these ballistic missiles fly so fast, fly so high, no system can intercept them. Bang, 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 8 times they landed their missiles on the Israeli Air Force base, proving that Iran's got the ballistic capability and Israel doesn't have the defensive wherewithal in order to resist it. So, in a sane world, we would now have, yes, the end of strategic patience on the part of Iran, whereby it allows Israel to mount terrorist operations in its country, kill its diplomats, kill its soldiers, kill its visiting potentates from the government, and does nothing in reply. That era has ended. Iran's strategic patience has run out. And a balance has been reached, a strategic balance. In a sane world, that would be the end of it. Each side would know that there were lines that it could not cross. And there are signs that in Washington, that's what Biden is trying to achieve. At least that is what his people are briefing the media to that end. But of course, the political arithmetic inside the Israeli cabinet, about which we've spoken on here so many times, is such that it's very doubtful whether Netanyahu, even if he wanted to, could stop an Israeli response tonight or tomorrow. Whatever Joe Biden says, he's only the guy that pays for it all. He's only the guy that covers for it at the United Nations. It's not Joe Biden that Netanyahu has to worry about. It's Ben-Gvir and the other fascist warmongers in his cabinet that call the shots. And so it seems that the Israeli cabinet has decided that within 24 to 48 hours, it is going to hit Iran. And Iran has very clearly said that if Israel hits Iran, the Iranian response to that will be 10 times more severe than happened last evening. Now, project forward where all this is headed. Israel hit Iran many times, but hit Iran on April the 1st. Iran waited 2 weeks for Israel's allies to rein it in. They did not, so Iran hit back under the self-defense provisions in international law. If Israel now hits back against Iran's hit back, Iran will hit back 10 times more severely. Where does that end? It ends with the Straits of Hormuz blocked. As Iran proved just yesterday, it can do just like that. Seized an Israeli ship, container ship, in minutes. It can block the Straits of Hormuz, through which 40% of all the world's oil passes. Do the maths. As I said in the last show, you won't be able to buy petrol at $50, $100 for a gallon. You won't be able to buy it at all. The wheels of industry will instantly stop in Western countries. The allies of the United States, the allies of Israel, in the Arab region, will be set on fire. Places that you know well, that you will have visited, maybe you've even got an apartment there, will cease to exist, will be wiped off the map. Any Arab collaborator with an Israeli attack on Iran will be treated as a belligerent and will be destroyed. Where are we headed here? We're headed for Netanyahu dragging Biden into a wide Middle Eastern war. But Russia has refused to condemn Iran's actions last night. China has refused to condemn Iran's actions last night. China and Russia are Iran's allies. Do you think for a moment that Russia and China are going to allow Netanyahu and Biden to destroy Iran? If you believe that, you'll believe anything. So when Iran, Russia, and China are in a war with Israel, the United Kingdom, and the United States, trust me, all the others will run away. All of them will run away. Even little Macron, beating his corset earlier today. Even little Macron. It'll be Israel, the United States, and the United Kingdom against Iran, Russia, and China. Hold your children close, because that is World War III. Stay tuned. It's the mother of all talk shows.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Shireen Malherbe is a Palestinian novelist and children's author. And of course, most of the people who've been murdered in the last 6.5 months in Gaza have been children and women, mothers and children, 71%. But what about the children who were not killed? but who have been traumatized almost beyond a novelist's imagination. Well, Shireen is quite a novelist. We'll be talking to her now. Shireen, welcome to the Mother of All Talk Shows. Before we get into literary matters, and I'm keen to talk about your latest book, I'm right, haven't I, that an entire generation of Palestinian children, not just in Gaza, but in these pogroms going on right now in the West Bank, have been, well, let's just say their lives have been changed probably unalterably. How does one begin as a Palestinian parent to maintain equilibrium amongst our young children?
Hi, George. Thanks for inviting me to the show. It's a great question. And I think it's one that we're all battling to answer. And actually, that is something we're going to try and answer soon as I'm embarking on a book called actually Oh, Children of Palestine, which really tries to bring the hope to Palestinian children. I think we mustn't underestimate the strength that Palestinian children have. I've been watching the videos coming out of journalists there and Middle East Eye. The most recent one asked a young girl, you know, will you come with me now? Will you leave the camp? And she said, no, I won't. And he said, are you scared? And she said, you know, it's normal to be scared. But whether I die here or whether I leave and I die outside of my homeland, what's the difference? It doesn't make me immortal. And I think what we're seeing in terms of their strength, their faith and their steadfastness is something that people are looking at and maybe, you know, not fully understanding. And that's because, you know, a lot of things are looked at in Palestine from a Eurocentric view. And I think, you know, without really truly understanding why Palestinians stay, why they stay in their homeland and the strength of their faith, you can't really understand, you can't understand much about how they'll grow up to continue to be strong. You know, we have had the Nakba, the anniversary was just recently, the first one, or one of the first, over 75 years ago. And, you know, the survivors of this Nakba, they go on to have families and children, and they learn everything it is to be Palestinian and to stay and fight for the land. And I don't think that we should underestimate that there will be growth, and out of the rubble, these children, you know, they're going to build the future there.
Well, I mean, we live in a society in the West where, you know, people claim they've got PTSD because, you know, they saw a dog getting run over. What kind of PTSD would the children of Palestine be suffering in the wake of 6.5 months of literally picking up their siblings' bodies and carrying them? The impact of it all has to be... I'm not doubting in any way the resilience of Palestinian children or their faithfulness to their religion, to their cause, but the damage, the mental health damage, just simply has to be extreme, no?
Yeah, of course. I mean, as adults, I think we're all struggling to try and work out how to... what to do. You know, we've seen lots of people marching, we've seen protests, we've seen people, you know, shouting at politicians in parliament saying, this has got to stop. And this is grown adults, you know, who are able to process it maybe, you know, slightly better than children. And yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine what it must be that they're going through. And that's why it was really important to, you know, speak directly to the children of Palestine and say, we are with you. You know, listen, we're with you as much as we can possibly be with you, with our voices, with our bodies, through our actions, through every single thing it is we are trying to do. And, you know, because of what they've seen and how they'll grow, you know, this is something that we're going to need supporting on for a very long time. And this is exactly why I write books, because a lot has been spoken about propaganda, about media bombardment. This isn't something that's happened recently. This has been going on for absolutely decades. This complete dehumanization of Muslim lives has been you know, it's been going on since Edward Said wrote Orientalism, this absolute obsession with othering the Muslim, of the Muslim as someone to fear. Well, we're seeing the consequences of that through the most horrific ways, through this genocide. And you said it yourself, George, in one of your talk shows this week, about the seven aid workers who were murdered. It took seven. So the statistics are 5,000 to one, you said, you know, for it to invoke and infuriate reactions from people. Why has it taken the death of seven Europeans versus, I think the figure when I last looked was over 15,000 children. I mean, this, we're in a state which, yeah, you know, we haven't been in before. And I think we're all sort of trying to grapple with how we move forward in a way that helps and supports and shouts for Palestinians and Palestinian children, both now and in the future.
Well, of course, even that hiatus over the seven foreign aid workers only lasted 24, maybe 48 hours. It looked like the Western governments had lost their confidence and were beginning to rethink, but they quickly got over it. Even the deaths of the British and Irish and Canadian, American, and I think German aid workers has quickly been forgotten, and Israel has faced no consequences. Just yesterday, when the Bondi Beach mass murderer killed seven people, the entire Western media went bananas, describing him as a Muslim fanatic. And when he passed the colour test and turned out to be a white guy called Joel, it was quickly relegated to mental health problems, not terrorism at all. Quickly move on. So even in our countries, Shireen, the trauma of this last 6.5 months, it's going to take a long time to go away, isn't it?
A very long time. And, you know, this is something that, as well, Palestinians have been living with since, you know, even before 1948. So that date, for viewers who don't know, is when the first Nakba happened. And Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe. And that's when Jewish gangs stormed the village of Deir Yassin. And actually, you know, there's a lot of parallels or similarities between what happened that long ago and also what we're seeing today. Some of those are that the attack happened when the men were at Friday prayer. So they knew that the women and children would be on their own. We then had the parading and the celebration of their bodies, of the captives that were kept alive. Then we had the lies and propaganda. And then we had the absolute denial that the Nakba ever happened. So, you know, what we're seeing for people who are saying, oh, you know, this is really recent. Actually, it's not. This has been happening and has happened for nearly 80 years. And, you know, they can't be separated. We're seeing, you know, very similar behavior to what happened in the first instance at the creation of the state of Israel back in 1948. The difference now is, shockingly, the world is watching it, so it can't be denied. Yet the lives of those who are being murdered are so devalued to the point that they don't seem to care. I mean, Joe Biden's eating an ice cream when they're asking if you're going to stop genocide and stop killing, you know, thousands and thousands of children. The detachment seems unreal. And that's why I don't think we should underestimate the power that the media has. I know everyone is more aware now of media bias, but let's look at what we've been bombarded with for the past 50 years. Let's look at every film, series, book that is available on the market about Muslims. I did Muslim representation before I started writing novels, and it's shocking. You know, the way Muslims have been positioned has allowed for not just Palestine to happen, but for, you know, the wars in Iraq, Iran, Yemen. Their lives do not, our lives do not matter as much. And this is why people can perhaps take a view that it's collateral. You know, there doesn't seem to be the furiousness that there should be about what's happening right now. Mm. And I truly believe
because I'm keen to talk about your book. Forgive me cutting you off. Yassini Girls, a semi-autobiographical novel. How semi-biographical? And tell us about the book.
Okay, so my personal journey is Yassini Girls. It's my exploration of my own family history relating back to the Nakba. So I was on the BBC in this last spring, and they did a program called The Holy Landowners, Our Untold Stories. And my I found out that my grandma, my Tata, I always assumed that my whole family lived in the West Bank in Ariha, and I found out she was actually from Deir Yassin. And I mentioned this on a talk show when I was talking about my last Palestinian novel, The Land Beneath the Light. And a BBC director was watching and contacted me and said, would you like to find out about your family history? We were doing a program on the creation of the State of Israel. And it was a very long process of months. And in the end, I did do the filming, and we traveled to Palestine for 5 days to do the filming. And I discovered that my family were originally from Deir Yassin, the village of the massacre. We lost 22 members of my family that day. And I just felt like the program split between the Jewish journey. So honestly, I've only actually watched it once because it was just really difficult to watch the position of Palestine and Israel when I knew my family and many others had been murdered then. And I just felt like there was more to say. So Yassini Girls is my exploration of it, because I feel like the journalist after the show said, oh, you know, they swung, you know, the Guardian said, this is revolutionary. They've said the Nakba on TV. And, you know, that was one of my reasons for doing it, because, you know, the research is watertight. It cannot be denied. It happened. It happened exactly how people had said it had happened. But the other side was that, you know, it was kind of Eurocentric and still cheated the Palestinians. And I just felt like it was such a complex issue and so personal to me that I needed to write my own Palestinian version of the two stories that I discovered that day. One was my own, and another was a survivor that I met who was actually neighbors with my family. And I met her in Jerusalem. And, you know, what I realized was the Nakba and that day to her, they didn't happen in a vacuum years ago that people maybe mentioned. You know, she lived this day in, day out in her 80s, and she's still, you know, obviously distraught about it. And the only reason she spoke to me on the program, she said to me, is because, you know, she knows my family. And I just felt like all these stories from Palestine, nobody ever gets to see. Nobody is, even if you are blessed enough to visit Palestine, you still do not see Palestinian lives. And with my books, I feel like it's a window, or even, you know, be invited inside, spend time with Palestinians, eat with us, see how we celebrate, you know, see how we live, because there's life as well. And I think if you really saw and read these intimate portrayals of Palestinian lives, they wouldn't be able to be devalued to the extent that they are.
How do people get it, Shireen?
Well, it's actually coming out in the summer, but you can pre-order now. You can either do it on my website at shireenmalherbe.com, or you can go onto my publisher's website at beaconbooks.net.
Lovely. Best of luck with it. Hope it sells well. Thanks for joining us on the Mother of
Talk
Shows. Coming up after the break, it's the one and only Scott Ritter. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Well, the G7, the mouse that roared, is standing by to take other measures, but does not want to further destabilize the situation, which seems something like a contradiction to me. We'll be talking with Scott Ritter, former Marine officer, former United Nations weapons inspector, a man who knows more about war than almost anybody else on the planet, certainly anybody else that's active in public life trying to warn people of the very real dangers of the situation we are now in. I'm glad to say he's with us. Now, Scott, let's talk, if we may, about, first of all, what happened before moving on to what might happen next. If you would describe for us, with your peerless experience, what happened in the Iranian attack on Israel last night?
Well, simply put, what happened is that the Iranian government has established a publicly discernible policy on deterrence. They have let Israel know, and not just Israel, they have let the United States and every other nation in within missile range know that there will be a heavy price to be paid if you attack Iranian soil, that Iran will not tolerate the kind of attack that took place on the 1st of April, where Israel attacked the Iranian consulate in Damascus. And I believe Iran is also putting a marker on the table that says Iran will no longer tolerate the kind of actions such as the assassination of nuclear scientists on its soil by Israel in the past. This will not be tolerated. That in the future, if you choose to attack Iran, Iran will retaliate, and they will retaliate with the kind of force that cannot be interdicted and the kind of force that will destroy that which it is seeking to destroy. Now, the Iranians were very clever in creating this posture, in that all they had to do was show a proof of concept. I think a lot of people were saying, well, they didn't destroy an airfield. They didn't destroy an Israeli headquarters. They didn't kill hundreds or thousands of Israelis. They weren't intending to. They were simply letting the Israelis and the Americans know that we have the capacity to destroy an airfield. All the Israelis have to do is look at a map, look where the Iranian missiles hit, and understand that the Iranians hit that which they were aiming at. And there was nothing Israel could do to stop those missiles from reaching their target. And Israel is the most heavily defended airspace in the world, with the most sophisticated anti-missile technology deployed in depth, and they couldn't stop the Iranian missiles. So the signal to the United States, which lacks this comprehensive air defense umbrella over its installations in the Middle East, is there too, but for the grace of God, go you, if you choose to attack us or facilitate an Israeli attack. So this was, I call it one of the greatest military demonstrations in modern history, because by doing what they did, Iran not only put Israel into check, but believe it or not, they have created a foundation for peace and stability in the Middle East by eliminating from consideration options that Israel and the United States may have been considering down the road, such as a preemptive strike against Iranian nuclear facilities or a punishing attack against the Iranian regime. The United States and Israel are now on notice that if they attempt to do something like that, the price they will pay will be prohibitively high. In the case of Israel, it might be terminally high.
Help those of us who don't know weapons and systems like you do, Scott. I said earlier in my monologue that the very slow-moving drones and then the cruise missiles that were launched, second-rate, second-grade ones, were to, as it were, draw the anti-missile fire to exhaust it. It's very expensive. It's in rather short supply. And then to, as a coup de grace, if you like, deliver the ballistic missiles, which cannot be, were not stopped, were not interdicted, were able to land on their target, the airbase in the Negev. Have I got that right? And can you help further explain?
Certainly. First of all, let's just point out the reality that Iran started this attack by launching the slowest, loudest weapons in its arsenal, the Shahed drones. And they did that because they were sending a signal to Israel, the United States, and everybody, we're attacking Israel. Now, if they were looking to carry out, you know, a lethal attack, why announce it 5 hours in advance? Why give Israel a chance to withdraw its high-valued assets from bases of that are vulnerable? Why give the United States, Great Britain, and France chance to move resources up, ships, airplanes over Jordan, to intercept these missiles? Iran was saying, here we come, shoot us down. And they did. They came out and they shot the drones down. Now, Iran launched tens of millions of dollars worth of drones. The United States and Israel spent billions of dollars shooting them down. This is a financial equation that's unsustainable. And that was one of the points that Iran was making, is you can't afford this kind of war. Then they sent in cruise missiles that, combined with the drones, defined the initial phase of the air defense reaction. Not only the air defense, the airplanes, but once they penetrated the airplanes, the Iron Dome started engaging. And they brought in missiles at a higher level so that the aero systems and the Patriots started to engage. And they defined the radar. They defined how Israel's locking in on the targets. And then they did three things. And this is where it gets iffy. I have to be honest, George, it's very early and there's incomplete information out there. But my understanding is that Iran used three types of ballistic missiles. One ballistic missile, it's a very clever missile. It uses a warhead that separates and then fires, burst fires, a bunch of decoys out there that appear to be specifically designed to absorb Iron Dome missiles. So remember, the Iron Dome is tracking a target. You fire these decoy bursts, and so the Iron Dome says, aha, we have now 25 targets, and they fire 25 interceptors. Meanwhile, smaller warheads, maneuverable, burst through those interceptors and go down and hit the Israeli air defense systems. And that appears to be the case. I was looking at some video where you see this taking place, the shotgun effect of these bomblets, the Iron Dome responding and then coming in, and they hit the air defense system. So they're showing the Israelis how we're going to take you out. The next thing that you see is they have these missiles coming in where you see the warhead separating from the missile body. And then there's a booster engine on the warhead that drives it down into the ground at high speed, blowing away any radar intercept, any ability to intercept, hitting the target. And what this does is it clears the space. They clear air defense. And the final thing are these heavy warheads that come off of the heavy missiles that hit the runways and blew the big craters in them. This was a three-layered ballistic missile attack that was specifically designed by the Iranians to destroy Israeli air defense, to clear the way, to take out air defense, and then to show that we can put the big warheads on the target anywhere in Israel we want to. And this was successful. And the beauty of this is they didn't use their best missiles. All three, with the exception, one of these missiles is rather new, but it's not the hypersonic missile. Israel didn't use their hypersonic missile. And Israel has lots of these missiles. This was just a single strike package. Iran has several strike packages just like this held in reserve that they have for Dimona, that they have for the Kirya in Tel Aviv, that they have for other air bases. Iran can repeat this process all day long. And what they showed Israel is, this is what we can do. And I can guarantee you there's people like me right now who wear uniform or intelligence officers doing the exact same analysis they're doing. And they're writing big critical reports up the chain of command saying, stop all nonsense. We can't win this war. It's over, guys. Stop it. We have no defense here. If Iran wants to come in, we are powerless. This thing will escalate out of control. Make it stop now, which is why Joe Biden was on the phone with the G7 to intervene with Israel, why Joe Biden was on the phone with Netanyahu, and why Netanyahu's generals were telling him, stand down. We can't win this fight. This is a huge Iranian victory.
Yeah, we'll come to that latter point in a minute. But do you agree with me that, as George W. Bush might put it, they've all misunderestimated Iran all along?
Well, again, the military hasn't. I have to say that I've worked with Israeli intelligence, with their technical intelligence people, with the people who do the analysis and the assessments of missiles. These are smart people. And if I, sitting here thousands of miles away without any access to secret information, could have said I knew most of this going in before this happened, I knew what Iranian capabilities were, I can guarantee you they knew exactly what this was. But the problem is getting their voice heard by Israeli policymakers who are driven by emotion and by politics, domestic politics, etc. What this attack did is empower their voices, because now, whereas political leaders could say, well, you're just speculating, you don't know, that's just geeky intelligence stuff, now they have the hard data, the photograph put on the table, the air defense guy saying, boss, we gave it our best shot. There's nothing we can do to stop them. The Americans calling up saying, there's nothing more we can do. We did everything. We can't stop this. And now the Israeli politicians are waking up to the harsh reality that the fiction that they have been living, living under is not even close to reality. It was a fantasy, and there's a real world out there, and it's a dangerous world, and they're going to have to change the way that they operate.
So let's move on to what happens next, Scott, if you will. It's said, and you've just said it, the media is saying it, I believe it, that Biden has sought to dissuade. In what words and at what price, who knows, but sought to dissuade an Israeli response to Iran's response for fear of this wider conflagration, for fear of a serious, 10 times more serious, Iranian response to any Israeli response. But the question is, can Netanyahu survive without responding? Listening to Ben-Gvir and others already this evening, it seems to me that Netanyahu would fall from power were he to go along with what Biden seems to be asking him to do.
There's a couple of things that I think we're going to see. One, I think we're going to see Israel ratcheting up the pressure on Hezbollah. And now we're going to have to see, the skills of Hassan Nasrallah and his ability to manage this escalation ladder, which he's done so masterfully. But more pressure is going to be put on Hezbollah by Israel. And Iran is going to be pressuring Nasrallah not to allow it to blow up, not to allow it to become the general war that Netanyahu so desperately needs. Two, I think Netanyahu is going to call in the head of Mossad and sit Ben-Gvir down with him and say, we're going to double down on our covert war against Israel. You know, there a lot of people have forgotten, but there was a huge demonstration last year that became a civil war. I talked to senior Iranian officials about it, and they said, this isn't demonstrations. This is a hybrid war run by the CIA and Israeli Mossad designed to bring Iran down from within. And it was a big problem. It was a big fight. The Iranians won. They prevailed. But I would see Israel encouraging Baluch nationalist movements to strike Iran and Zahedan. I would see them encouraging ISIS to strike inside Israel. I would encourage them to see the Kurds striking, the Mujahideen al-Talq striking, all these external forces that the CIA, the British, and Israeli intelligence have been propping up for years. I think you're going to see the Israelis saying, you need to double down on this stuff. We need to put the pressure on Iran because we can't be seen as doing nothing. We have to be seen as doing something. And this, again, will test the limits of Iran's deterrent policy. At what point in time will Iran expand it to say that that hybrid attacks using a proxy qualifies as the same as a direct attack, and our deterrence will kick in as well? We dodged a bullet, but we're not out of the firefight yet. There's going to be a lot of pressure put on down the road. The good news is Iran doesn't want to fight. They're not cowards. They proved that they will fight if need be. But Iran's focus is on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's on BRICS. It's on normalization of relations with Saudi Arabia. It's on economic prosperity. And a war with Israel will disrupt all of this. So the good news is there's a lot of patience built into Iran's foreign policy, a lot of flexibility. And that's necessary at this point in time because Iran has to understand that Israel has to do something for internal politics. And you either want a war or you don't. If you don't want a war, you're going to have to grit your teeth and bear it as Israel uses proxy forces to put pressure on Iran to punish Iran. Iran will have to absorb these attacks. But the other good news is Israel's losing the bigger war. Remember, the other thing Iran doesn't want to do is distract attention away from the fact that Hamas is winning, that Hamas has turned global opinion against Israel, that the world is now talking about a Palestinian state in ways that they had never done before. A larger war between Israel and Iran distracts people from that goal. And Iran doesn't want that. Iran understands that the axis of resistance together with Hamas was in the process of strategically defeating Israel. And that's the fight they want to fight. So I think Iran will be willing to absorb blows from Israeli proxies in order to stay focused on the strategic victory that they're handling and not fall victim to the kind of, petty human narcissism that Israel falls victim to, where they say, We've been slighted. We have to do massive revenge. Iran has shown itself to be a very patient, very resilient, very mature nation state when it comes to this sort of activity.
Finally, Scott, and I'm grateful for your time as always, the English-speaking king of Jordan, who, when he took the throne, literally could not speak Arabic and now speaks it with a rather splendid English accent. He was the only Arab leader, if we can call him an Arab, call him a leader, who collaborated with Israel and the United States last night. Even their much more important and longer standing allies declined the opportunity to do that. Why did King Abdullah do that? Has he not placed himself in very severe difficulty now with his own population, which is overwhelmingly opposed to Israel, overwhelmingly in support of the Palestinians in Gaza? What on earth forced King Abdullah to do that?
Well, I call him the least Arab leader in the Arab world. As you pointed out, he, you know, his roots, his ideology, his mindset is very British. It's not it's not of the Arab street. He is so far removed from the reality of his people, and he is so dependent upon Israel, and I put Israel first, then the United States and in Europe for his continued viability as a leader. His betrayal of the Palestinian cause is apparent to all. And now his betrayal of the Arab world and indeed the Muslim world is on display likewise. He knows he's in a lot of trouble. The most dangerous thing in the world for the Hashemite king of Jordan is happening. And that is that the Palestinian people have a pathway to statehood. And a Palestinian state is perhaps the greatest threat to this artificial entity called the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Because he's not a Jordanian. He is a Saudi Arabian transplant. And his, I believe that he may be the last Hashemite king of Jordan. That I don't wish upon him the fate of the last Hashemite king of Iraq. But I do believe that it's time for the king of Jordan to take his family and his retinue and fly off to London and live where he belongs among the British people he so adores. Because he is reviled and hated amongst his own people, and now amongst the entire Arab and Muslim world. He is a betrayer of the cause of the people of Palestine.
So, World War III or not, Scott, can we sleep in our beds tonight with some confidence that the world will still be here when we wake up in the morning?
I'd say in the short term, as long as Ben-Gurion Airport is open and flights are coming in and out, go to bed, sleep well. If Ben-Gurion shuts down, then we need to start worrying about in what direction this is going, because the Iranians aren't playing around anymore. And if Ben-Gurion shuts down, it means the Israelis aren't taking no as an answer from the United States. And this thing could go in any direction. But for the moment, Ben-Gurion's open. People are flying in and out. I'd say you can sleep well tonight.
They're more flying out than in. Thank you, Scott Ritter, as always, for your wisdom, your experience, and your eloquence.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Ramazan is a highly popular, highly successful political analyst and podcast host and joins us now. Rama, welcome to the Mother of All Talk Shows. You've picked a fine time to join us as we might stand on the brink of Armageddon. What did you make, and what are you saying in your analysis, your podcast, about the place we now are in, about the juncture we now are at?
Well, this is the natural course of events, and this is what we've been saying from day one. Allowing the occupation to get away with all the war crimes that they've been filming, by the way, which is another interesting part to this whole farce. They've been filming their war crimes, circulating them audaciously on social media channels. And everyone has sort of warned that because this occupation is losing, they are going to drag the region into a war. And why is this the case? Because they are clearly losing. So they are covering up this loss by attempting to get the U.S. dragged into the region. And they don't get to play the victim card. What they're trying to do now, because they've so obviously lost the narrative, is they're trying to pick it back up by putting Iran into the equation, which is not going to work anymore because they've been so thoroughly exposed. And the thing is, to those who think they are betting on the winning horse, I would urge them to think again, because we are now watching the beginning of the end of this occupation.
Yes, I kind of feel that, though, like any labor, there will be a lot of pain before we see the end result. But I tend to think that you are right. I'm interested in the dynamic that occurred last night. It seems to me that almost all of the U.S. allies declined to be involved in defending Israel last night, refused to allow their bases to be used, their airspace to be used, etc., except Jordan. I happen to think that the Jordanian monarchy has put itself in danger now. What do you think?
With regards to what is happening in Jordan, honestly, I don't understand the chokehold that has been put over Jordan that is not allowing it to stand more vehemently with what's happening in Palestine. But what I can clearly say is that the allowing of this occupation to grow and to continue its war crimes so confidently is not just going to put the region in trouble. And this is something that everyone, not just me, that everyone has been talking about before. You allow these people to continue with these war crimes without any, with total impunity, and for them to now play the victim card is not going to work. I'm not going to focus on I feel like it's such a distraction to turn the narrative away from this occupation that has been going, that is basically the pet project of the West, gone rogue and has been rogue for so long, but now has been exposed as to how rogue it is because they're not even listening to their master anymore. So I don't even think that the conversation should go onto Iran, onto Jordan, onto any other entity, but the total fact and the total tunnel vision of a key message here, which is that these are a people that have been allowed for so long to not just hit at Palestine, but now they've hit at three other countries. And when a retaliation happens, they have the audacity to act as if it is an action, not a reaction. And what has to happen now is that they have to be held accountable. And the odd and sick relationship between the United States and this occupation is again showcasing the danger that they are putting into that they are putting the world in. A blundering Biden eating ice cream while discussing a sort of Armageddon, as you stated, is absolutely farcical. And the UK Prime Minister sending off a letter, a harsh letter, and asking people to read my words, it's an absolute farce. And it's and the thing is, in the region, in Arabia, the anger is felt. The anger is felt. I'm not going to be talking about leaders here. I really vehemently believe in a grassroots movement. I'm now discussing the people. I'm not discussing the political leaders. It's not my concern. My concern is people are frustrated to a level because we've been spoon-fed this fantastical idea that democracy is only in the West, that modernism is only tied to the West, and any other problem, be it women's rights, any of these issues are only focal to our region when these are international issues. I'm not saying we don't have our problems, but they're international problems. So this sick idea of this manipulation in order to allow us to continue to be colonized and make it seem like we are the ones that are oppressed, the terrorists only are here, is extremely dangerous. And that is the narrative that is going to be used by this occupation with Iran's involvement. They're going to go, oh, see, this is what we've warned you about. No, this is what we've warned you about. Your pet project from day one in our region has been a plague and has continued as such. And what we are seeing unfold right now, the beginning of the end, was absolutely inevitable. You know, we have this phrase that's ma buni ala batil fa huwa batil. What has been built on injustice and corruption is unjust and corrupt. And this is why it is not sustainable in our region. These are Westerners with a different thought, where Zionism is one that is innate to supremacy, innate with this mentality of a better, it is given to us, slaughtering children in thousands, so blatantly so, and they don't have a sense of remorse. So I am shocked.
Oh no, no remorse. They're videoing themselves doing it. They think it's an attractive look. That's how alien they are. Alien to all of us, not just to the people in the region. How do people see your podcast, Rama? I'd like people to follow you.
Well, right now I'm with Raw Politic, and we are present on YouTube. I'm actually really not tech savvy, so I wouldn't know the link. So I just YouTube Rahma Zain or Raw Politic, and I think you'll find us. I'm with a co-host, Mary. She's more of the law, better with the jargon. She's more politically savvy for sure and more diplomatic than my non-diplomatic self. So she's my co-host, Mary, and you can find us on YouTube.
I don't know. I felt you were quite diplomatic, actually. Thank you, really? Rama Zain, political analyst and podcast host. I did. Yes, I did. Probably the last call, I would think, maybe two. Hassan is in Canada on Iran. Go ahead, Hassan.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good, by the grace of God. Thank you. Go on.
Yes, I wanted to ask you in regards to the situation with Israel and Palestine. Sorry, not Israel and Iran. When Israel attacked the Iranian embassy, there was no outcry or no condolences. But all of a sudden now that the Iranians have sent attacked Israel, all of a sudden everyone's making noise. All these leaders are coming on and condemning Iran. What do you think about that?
Well, I've been talking about it for the last 2 hours, and I've been writing about it for the last few months and weeks, so you'll need to listen back to what I think about that. The reality is that not only were there no condolences, not only was there no condemnation, Britain and the US and France stopped the United Nations from condemning what was very obviously a criminal act. I mean, literally a criminal act, not just a wicked act or a bad act, but a criminal act under their own laws, the laws that they support, that they drew up. Who made the Vienna Convention in the 1940s to protect diplomats and embassies? We did, because we didn't want our embassies and our diplomats harmed, though many of them were, especially by Israeli terrorists. But don't get me started, because I don't have time. I've only got time for the legend. That's Tommy in Glasgow. He's the last caller. Go ahead, Tom.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear brother. How are you doing?
Alaikum salam. By the grace of God, good, thank you. I'm feeling better since Ross County results came in.
Yes, indeed. Inshallah, that's in the bag. Well, I was down helping you, brother, in the last days, trying to get you through to the election. Inshallah, maybe get to see you in the future. I saw what a brother, I opened my mouth to someone outside of South Africa. Forgive me, I don't remember his name. I just said a couple of words and he went, "Are you the legend? It's Tommy." And I went a bit reddish, but anyway, alhamdulillah, it was good. And may I just say, I've been coming down there and helped you, and I was glad, but commiserations for getting into that place. And you know what I mean, George, when I say commiserations for being amongst them, but alhamdulillah,
Rochdale is a wonderful place, Tom. It's the parliament. Although I actually like the building and I like the staff, but by God, some of the fellow members of parliament, you wouldn't wish them on your worst enemy, Tom.
That's why I'm saying commiserations on that one, George. But yeah, yeah, Rochdale was a lovely place. First time I've been down there. I did notice the state of the private hired vehicles. They were a bit quite old. I think if you paid £20, you would get the fare and the taxi for some of the state of the cars. But anyway, I digress. What I'd like to say is, inshallah, I've made a plan and intention to go to Al-Quds, Masjid Al-Aqsa, as of next week. It's all up in the air now with what is happening. But anyway, if any brothers are out there, make dua that I can get there and get back. Otherwise, this may be with my last call, and I need to make it with the best. Alhamdulillah, all praise for the one true God. What happened there yesterday, can I just say that the Prophet ﷺ was asked by his companions, "Oh yeah, Rasulullah ﷺ, when will the last day come?" And he says, "It will come when the time when people will sit around a table and the feast will be the Muslims." And his companion says, "Why will this be? Will there be so few of us?" He said, "No, there'll be so many, but you will be the flotsam and the jetsam." Now, myself, I was of the flotsam and the jetsam up until 5 weeks ago tonight, and I went back to the masjid for the first time in a long time, and I put my hands on it and said, "Ya Allah, you brought me to your religion. Please do not... please bring me back." You take one step, and he took two back, and I managed to have the most blessed of Ramadans. And I'm Mr. LastMinute.com, so either it's my last few days on this earth or the world is ending soon. And what happened there yesterday, the Prophet, peace be upon him, was also asked, you know, what events will happen? And he said, a city that is half in the land and half in the sea succumbs to people who are crypto Muslims, that is, professing the face of Islam. And they would say, "La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah." They would say it thrice, and the walls and the booty would become theirs. And that was what they knew at the time. It was Constantinople, it was Istanbul. Lo and behold, 70,000 crypto Muslims, Zionists to be told, Kemal Ataturk and his crew, went in, and that was 1908. And he said, the Prophet ﷺ said that 6 years after it would be what's known as the Great War. And yeah, we're in the pampered West. We can say there's World War One and World War Two, World War Three, whatever. But World War One has never stopped for the majority of the planet, especially the people in Palestine. And also, to finish off, he also mentioned that the Dajjal would rise for 100 years. Now, people have always questioned the timing of that, but the Prophet ﷺ, he was asked when... Islam would be diversified from the religion and the political, and that would come after 30 years. And the Dajjal for the 100 years, if you look, the Islamic Caliphate that was destroyed asunder, I think it was on the 5th of March, 1924. And now the last 100 years, and that's just there, the 100th anniversary, the last 100 years, tremendous scientific advances have been made in that time. Is the Dajjal amongst us? Who knows? Is the time coming where we're going to have to be saying cheerio to our friends? Well, if that happens, be it moist in your tongue. Ashhadu Allah, ilaha illallah, ashhadu Allah, Muhammad Rasulullah. Peace be upon all the brothers and sisters, and that's Muslims, non-Muslims, and inshallah, hopefully I can get a chance to speak to you again.
Well, thanks, Tommy. Well, I hope we do. It's a somewhat apocalyptic call from you to end on. I very much hope that you get to pray in Al-Aqsa, but look out for those red heifers that are there right now waiting to be burned as some kind of, I don't know, obscurantist ritual, which may very well lead to the destruction of the mosque that you're aiming to pray in. I wish we had more time. This has been a great show. And there's only 111 people waiting to get on the show right now, whom I've had to disappoint. I'm very sorry indeed about that. It's been rock and roll. Let's hope we're still here on Wednesday, because I'll be back, God willing, at the same time with the Wednesday edition of Moats. Millions of people are watching this show, sharing our clips on all of our platforms all over the world, and an increasing number are also taking our podcast. Please be among them and join me for Have It Out with Galloway, if you get the chance to.